You're listening to Radically Pragmatic, a podcast from the Progressive Policy Institute. We talk with lawmakers, policy experts, and thought leaders about the issues driving the news nationally and internationally. The Progressive Policy Institute is a catalyst for policy innovation and political reform with offices in Washington, D.C. and Brussels. Its mission is to create radically pragmatic ideas for moving America beyond ideological and partisan deadlock. We encourage analytical conversations, not your typical partisan talking points.
Welcome to the podcast. I am Diana Moss, Director of Competition Policy for the Progressive Policy Institute. On this episode, we are talking about competition in the live events markets. And we have two leading business and antitrust experts to help us unpack this timely and high-profile issue. Russ D'Souza is an online marketing and innovation expert, skills that he has brought very successfully to bear in co-founding SeatGeek in 2009, a well-known ticketing platform, and before that, Scribnia.com, a blogging, rating, and review site. Terrell McSweeney is senior of counsel for the law firm of Covington. She is an antitrust lawyer and former commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission. Her standout career also includes service at the U.S. Department of Justice Antitrust Division, the White House, and the Senate. Over the last several years, the magnitude of Live Nation's dominance in critical markets in the live event supply chain has galvanized public attention. It is difficult not to notice that dominance. With Ticketmaster's 70% share in ticketing and Live Nation's similar market share in exclusive contracts with venues, concert and sports fans, independent venues, and artists are now more vocal about their lack of choice. Little or even no choice is cited often as a leading indicator of a lack of competition in a market. And the history of antitrust tells us that dominant firms or monopolies often achieve and maintain their market positions through restrictive policies that limit competition. Live Nation is no different. And this is revealed through their policies and methods to disadvantage their competitors, favor their own products and services, and drive fans back to Ticketmaster's primary and secondary ticketing platforms. The Live Nation monopoly story is backed up by hard evidence of threats and exclusive contracts with venues that ensure that Ticketmaster will be the only ticketing platform available. And Live Nation's restrictive policies are also evident in the secondary markets, where fans often face hurdles in using their resale tickets. Overall, consumers face these adverse effects through high ticket fees, low quality service, and less innovation on digital ticketing platforms. We will talk about all of these issues and what can be done about it, including the different tools available, such as antitrust enforcement and legislative efforts. Welcome to the podcast, Terrell and Russ.
Thanks, Diana.
Thanks, Diana. Thrilled to be here, and thanks for all the work that you do.
Thank you very much. It's going to be a terrific conversation about a very important topic. So let's jump right in. Russ, I wanted to toss it to you first to give us
the
table setting on the ticketing markets. What's the state of competition as you see it from your position? And how are these boundaries between primary and secondary ticketing markets blurring?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think for someone who lives in the ticketing market every day, it's helpful to zoom out for our audience and to describe, I think, the dynamics of these markets in general. Resale and primary used to be very distinct. 2000 StubHub launched, and at that time, and you know, and for many years, the resale market was around shipping hard tickets to people when they bought a ticket. So the particular areas where a resale market would invest a lot of time and energy is around building obviously a good buying platform, but also everything from the fulfillment of those tickets, basically ensuring that the logistics of you bought a ticket, now it needs to be shipped in time to get to your address before the event. And there needs to be things like pickup locations in case you couldn't make that event, or you know, you pick up your ticket at the event, then a pickup location would be something that you would be able to use. And then in 2013, I remember the line started to really blur. And 2013 strikes me as a pretty notable time because a few developments started to really happen. The first is that Ticketmaster Plus launched, or at least I remember the NBA and other leagues announcing Ticketmaster Plus as a preferred destination for fans to go buy tickets. And what Ticketmaster Plus was they have all the primary inventory displayed on their interactive stadium maps, and they overlay that with secondary inventory too. So the lines really started to blur between what primary and secondary was, because you're going to the same shopping experience and seeing the same tickets. And what further facilitated that was the fact that ticketing became very, very quickly digital. And, you know, in some ways it's kind of crazy that people used to ship around hard tickets that contained a 18-digit integer for so long, but it moved very quickly to a ticket was bought on a particular platform, and you would get at first a PDF that you can go print out, and then very shortly thereafter, you know, in 2017, 2018, everything moved towards you're getting a ticket that's delivered to your phone. So the primary and secondary market became very, very tightly integrated together, and there's really blurring of the lines between those two things.
Thanks, Russ. That's really helpful. So I want to emphasize, I think, for our listeners, the importance of what Russ is saying about the blending or the blurring of lines between primary and secondary. You know, in the old days when we had a more distinct secondary market, that market was really, really important. And more generally, secondary markets are important. They provide an opportunity to match up more consumers with suppliers. They increase efficiency generally, but they have to be well-functioning and competitive to deliver all of these benefits of a market system. And I say this because later in the conversation, we'll talk about legislative efforts that are targeting secondary markets that may be working against the interests of competition and a market-based system. But generally, secondary markets are a good thing, but they've got to be working competitively for the benefit of consumers and teams and artists. Tara, before we get into the antitrust implications of some of this, any comments on sort of the state of play in the ticketing markets?
Well, I think your point is a good one, Diana and Russ as well, that in fact, things have changed a lot in ticketing markets in the last two decades. And especially actually during the pandemic and post-pandemic, we've seen another big shift towards digital ticketing. So what used to be an experience that we had in the brick and mortar world involving physical tickets has now basically been transformed into a completely digital experience where the ticket is bought online, you end up with a code on your phone, you almost never have a physical ticket, and maybe sometimes people still print out PDFs, but for the most part, it's a digital experience. And so that's another really big change, in many ways an extremely positive change in ticketing markets, but it's another really big change in how tickets are being sold to fans and how fans are receiving them and using them. You know, I think it continues potentially to blur the lines as well between the primary and secondary ticketing markets. But when we're thinking about these markets, just for lay listeners and normal, you know, fans out there, what we're talking about is the primary market where you, you know, bought the ticket for an event, maybe in an on sale, maybe you got online early and tried to get, you know, a ticket for a concert you really want to go to. And the secondary market is where what used to be kind of regarded as, you know, a market where there would be scalpers. I use that term, I understand it's a kind of loaded term, but where there would be, you know, you could buy tickets or sell tickets to an event after you've already purchased them, or we're looking to, maybe we didn't get lucky in the on sale and we're looking to buy them. And now that's a really digital experience. It used to be, I mean, when I was growing up, I guess I'll date myself, we would wait online to buy tickets, right? Or you would go find some guy around the corner from where you were going and try to find that seat, but you know, he was going to offer and hope those were good tickets and pay someone a lot of cash in a dark alley. That's not a great experience, by the way. And so one of the things that has really happened in the secondary market is the evolution of resale platforms and marketplaces where those transactions can be done a lot more safely, a lot more securely, and with guarantees associated with them as well. So it becomes an easier experience for a fan. This happens to me all the time, unfortunately, where maybe you made a plan to go to a concert several months out or a game, And then all of a sudden it's back to school night at your kid's school. So you're not going to that concert anymore. And you want to find a way to quickly, you know, move those tickets along. And that is, that's where you're in the secondary market and you're reselling the ticket.
I think that's a really good example too, because of having to not be able to make it to the event last minute and finding you need to resell your tickets, when you consider so many concert on sales happen 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 18 months before the actual event. So very few people know what they're doing next week. Who knows what they're doing in 18 months? Who knows if they'll be in the same city in 18 months? But people are making those investments to buy those tickets because they know there's a liquid resale market that they can utilize in case they can't make the event. So I think resale is something that is very clearly helping both consumers and helping the underlying artists, the sports team as well, because that flexibility enables a ticket to actually be more valuable.
Up on a point that you just made, Russ, which I think is important. It's not just benefiting fans to be able to resell a ticket if I can't use it, for example. It's also benefiting the artist or the venue, right? Because no one wants to end up with a bunch of empty seats just because people couldn't make, you know, bought tickets they couldn't end up using and then they go nowhere. That doesn't provide a good experience really for anybody.
Yeah. And it's money lost for the venue who's unable to take advantage of the fact that there's food and beverage dollars that are not being spent there. And as you point out, fewer people will buy those tickets. So one of the trends that I've seen is just how much more integrated into the way that particularly sports teams think about their tickets, large resellers are a part of. So they are, in the case of these large inventory partners, coming in and working with teams to take on large positions of inventory so they can also distribute those tickets more broadly than what's available to teams who can only usually sell their tickets on the primary market. And they can offload some of that risk. So rights holders are often not that interested in ensuring that they find out how much money they make the day of the event when people buy tickets, and we live in this last minute, wait till the very last moment to do anything world, which we should, right? Convenience is really something we value. So teams and art rights holders don't want to wait that long to see how their revenue will look. They'd much rather say, you know what, I'm fine to offload that risk to somebody else, and maybe they make a small premium for taking that risk on. So the resale market really helps the rights holders in that capacity.
The importance of the resale markets, the blending of the primary and the secondary markets, is really a critical factor in some of these legislative proposals that are really targeting the wrong thing, which is ticket transferability, which would impede or even shut down the resale markets altogether. That's number one. Number two is, and this is back to Terrell's really good point, you know, we're not in a bricks and mortar format anymore in ticketing. These are digital platforms, much like we've seen in the big high profile antitrust cases around the big techs. And so anything that's going on in the platform that can affect the competitive process is really important. Things like data collection, sensitive consumer data analytics used to enhance and enrich consumer data and to drive the value proposition of the ticketing platform, artificial intelligence and machine learning. I mean, these are all the things that have been brought up in the context of the big tech companies and competition issues surrounding them, but is also very present in the ticketing industry, especially in Ticketmaster's platforms, which utilize many of these mechanisms to drive fans back to Ticketmaster's platforms. So with that really good table setting, I wanted do a little bit of a deeper dive, Terrell, into how competition or antitrust enforcement fits in here. Obviously, we had the big 2010 merger of Live Nation and Ticketmaster, which created this vertically integrated behemoth, which covers artist management, concert promotion, venue management, ticketing, you name it. And so we have this wingspan under one company that covers the entire supply chain. But that case in 2010 and the decree that came out of it that put into place certain remedies and the modification of that decree in 2020 really only went to one competition issue, which was how Live Nation forces venues into accepting Ticketmaster as a primary sole ticketing platform, which then ices out or squeezes out smaller competitors. and potentially other ticketing platforms. So we're living in a different world. We still have the venue management problem, but now we have all the problems with limiting competition from other ticketing platforms, including primary and secondary ticketers. So give us a little bit of background on how antitrust has engaged in competition issues in live events.
Sure. Well, I think you're underscoring the fact that live events and live entertainment as an industry is an incredibly diverse, multifaceted industry that involves a lot of different layers and tiers: ticketing, acts, event promotion, managers, venue, right? All of these things are a part of this ecosystem that is actually pretty complicated. You know, I think the 2010 consent decree that the Department of Justice entered into, which allowed the Ticketmaster Live Nation transaction to move forward, has been pretty widely criticized because it involves some behavioral remedies that were very difficult for the Department of Justice to implement. It's unusual, too, that in 2020, the Trump administration took the step of extending the consent decree. You know, that a 10-year consent decree is not extended in that way very often. And of course, the enforcement agency in the Trump administration had a more conservative take on antitrust policy than the Biden administration currently does. So I think those are two pretty indicative facts that underscore the Department of Justice is paying close attention to competition issues in live entertainment. You know, I think the current administration has a really different policy around primarily vertical mergers. They are taking a much more aggressive enforcement approach to some of those transactions. That really wasn't the policy in 2010. And so it's understandable that the Department of Justice allowed the transaction to go forward, although it has been heavily criticized, as I noted, since. And I think it would be interesting in today's environment if they came forward with a similar transaction, if it would be cleared, I suspect it would face a lot more investigation in the current enforcement agency as well. So there's a consent decree, and that's part of how the Department of Justice is engaging. But there's also been publicly reported an investigation that the Department of Justice Antitrust Division is engaged in. And that could involve the consent decree. It also could involve additional conduct as well. We don't really know right now exactly what to focus on. So some of the types of conduct that they might be investigating could be potential violations of the Sherman Act Section 2, which is monopolization, or Section 1, which involves anti-competitive agreements, some of the agreements that we know, as you point out, Diana, they've been concerned about in the past involving exclusive arrangements. You know, I think one of the real interesting factors here is ticketing at the scale in which Ticketmaster operates is very challenging, right? It takes a tremendous amount of investment resources. And the Taylor Swift concert on sale is just a great example of how complicated this can actually be. So there are a lot of barriers here for other competitors to be able to provide similar services or to provide them scale as well, especially in the primary market. But as you noted, both Russ and Diana earlier in the conversation, the resale market has been far more competitive, perhaps because of the way in which the different marketplaces have grown up. You know, there's a lot more competition and entry and innovation happening in the secondary market than there is in the primary market right now. And I think that's another area that the antitrust enforcers should be really thinking about and focused on as well.
I think we have a really unique sort of set of circumstances here. We have an old antitrust case that was a merger case under Section 7 of the Clayton Act, which really can't be used anymore to undo the merger since it has been modified already. So that leaves, as you point out, Section 2 of the Sherman Act, monopolization case, or Section 1 of the Sherman Act, a case against anti-competitive agreements around these exclusive contracts. I think all of those mechanisms get to potentially different sources of market power and the exercise of market power by Live Nation. But Russ, I want to turn it back to you to do a deeper dive into the types of practices that you see Live Nation implement that limit competition from rival ticketing platforms. And if you would, maybe just focus first on the old problem, which is these exclusive contracts or threats involving venues that force them into taking Ticketmaster as their sole ticketing platform, and what effect that has on competition in the ticketing market and on teams and artists and consumers.
Absolutely. Happy to jump in here. So we spent the first part of our conversation talking about how primary and secondary are becoming blurred, and that primary does have an implication in resale. So the practices that happen in the primary market are not just scoped to the primary market, they have an impact and implication in the resale market as well. We've talked about all the benefits of resale, but I just want to make sure I touch on one point, because I think it is different than how people think about resale. There's a lot of data that suggests that tickets on the resale market are not always going for an excessive face value, but that, and some studies show that 40% of tickets are going below face value. I think it's a bit hard to pin down an exact number because the concept of face value is antiquated now. Teams are and artists are changing their prices in real time. But I think it's really important when we think about how do we offer the best price to consumers, and that we think about the fact that the resale market has done a great job of serving up tickets at the price that people are willing to buy the tickets for, because there's a marketplace that's in effect, and restricting it and limiting it will actually lead to higher priced and artificially high priced tickets for the consumer, which I think none of us would agree is a good outcome. So Ticketmaster currently has among the highest grossing arenas in the United States, about a 78% market share. And I don't think that is inherently a bad thing. Like it's okay if a company is so good that everyone wants to use them and that they are able to achieve a large market share as a result of that. So I don't think necessarily that is the particular problem, but it's the way in which that market share has been gained that I find highly problematic. And to illustrate my point, I'll actually turn to one of the six offenses found in the amended consent decree of 2020. And just reading through the language and where these type of threats come from, I think will illustrate to the audience just how severe the problem is. And again, these are not anecdotes sourced by me. These are coming from an investigation run by the DOJ. So they pointed out an example where the Ticketmaster president, so it's gone up that high, had tried to coerce a venue into using them as their primary ticketer, and said if they do not, the Ticketmaster response would, and here I'm quoting, would be nuclear. And though he, the Ticketmaster president, would deny it if I repeated it, Live Nation would never do a show in our building, and they would find other places for their content. And later goes on to say this will be a hill that they're willing to die on. Now, I wish that this was behavior and anecdote that is new, but these sort of threats and implications have been circling around our industry for a very, very long time. What we want is to be in a world where we can all compete on who can offer the best product and services to venues and offer the best products and services to clients. When you have a company with Ticketmaster's market share, as well as Live Nation's market share, which Live Nation is promoting much of the top 25 and top 50 acts that are touring at any point in the United States, the fact that these threats are being made and cataloged by the DOJ is super problematic. And you would think that that further explanation on the part of Live Nation would help quell some of these concerns, but I actually find it even more disturbing the type of rhetoric that comes out of senior executives at Live Nation. Mike Rapino was interviewed, and this is, I think, in 2019, and he noted something that I think is worth us just pausing on a little bit here. He says, the consent decree gets a lot of misconception. I negotiated it, and it's very simple. It says we can't threaten venues. We can't say to a Ticketmaster venue that they want to use a different ticketing platform, if you do that, we won't put shows in your building. And this is the point that's really important. It also says we can do what's right for our business. So we have to put the show where we make the most economics. And maybe that venue won't be the best economic place anymore because we don't hold the revenue. And I think it's really hard to absorb that language and not see it as a broad threat to any venue who is choosing to use a different ticketing system. And these are the type of statements that are made very publicly, right? He is at a conference when he made this statement. It was made very publicly. What is being said behind closed doors? And when you look at like the examples compiled by the DOJ, where there are, contrary to what Mr. Rapino says, specific threats being made, and then you look at this broad overall threat, it's not a surprise to me, unfortunately, that so many times in conversations that we have with clients and prospects who are interested in our primary ticketing technology, the concern circles back to what will the impact on my show count be? How will I be penalized and hurt by Live Nation? This is just incredibly disappointing, and it's held back live entertainment. The fact that these are the primary concerns that are so troubling and worrying to people who run these large venues and sports teams. And I'll close with a point that you made, Diana, which was about the competition in the resale market, where we have seen a great deal of competition. We've also seen places where there's strong competition in the primary market. In the EPL, which is the English Premier League, it's one of the largest soccer leagues in the world, there's very few, if any, concerts that come to those buildings. And those decisions are primarily made or exclusively made on the basis of who is going to provide me the best technology and service and the price of that technology and service, which is how the vast majority of technology decisions are made by any vendor or any company that's looking to buy technology in other fields. And what you see is a much different competitive landscape. Ticketmaster does not have nearly the same market share, which is surprising, right? They are so dominant in U.S. pro sports. Why are they barely even on the map when it comes to the EPL? And I think it's a good illustration of the fact that there's likely, when it comes to pure technology, that's not the driving decision that that's leading to the outcome that we have in the United States. There's actually other factors, and I would point to this one as being the one that's created the status quo where we are today.
Thanks, Russ. And you know, I think you raise a really, really good point that we in the competition advocacy community see all the time, which is a monopolist doesn't necessarily have to do anything to restrict competition. It is the threat that there will be dire consequences if market participants, customers, suppliers, distributors, if they don't fall into line and take the products forced on them by the monopolist, that they will be harmed and they will be squeezed out. So Ticketmaster, I think, the quotes you were reading really highlight this point, that it is the mere threat of retaliation by Ticketmaster that keeps everyone in line in the live events markets. And, that's a dire situation from a competition standpoint. I'd be curious to get Terrell's take on this. And but not only, do they operate on the threat of, they actually engage in exclusive contracts to really drive it home and to lock it in, that there will be no competition whatsoever in the ticketing platform. And I also want to say, from our perspective, work that I've done, a recent commentary I just wrote on breaking up Live Nation, that Ticketmaster also engages in practices that are designed to really hinder the functioning of resale. That things like ticket holdbacks, slow ticketing, revolving barcodes, all of this makes it really difficult for the fans themselves to avail themselves of the resale market. And so you have exhausted, discouraged fans trying to get tickets that perhaps they couldn't get in an on sale or had to wait to get for personal reasons or whatever. But all of this exhaustion and frustration that fans are feeling is an absolute mechanism that Ticketmaster uses to drive fans back to their own ticketing platforms. And those issues are very high profile now as well. And I talk in my commentary about potential antitrust remedies to address that and other problems as well. Terrell, any comments on practices and sort of the role of conduct and detection of anti-competitive conduct in constructing an antitrust case?
Well, let me say a couple of things, because my former agency, well, actually, I worked at both the antitrust division and the FTC, but I'm going to talk about the FTC for just a moment. So my former agency, the FTC, has also looked at some of the conduct that you're talking about, Diana, in ticketing markets. They held a workshop as well. And there's a staff report that was issued coming out of that that identifies some issues as more disclosure-oriented consumer protection issues and a little bit less antitrust focused. So I want to put that on the table that there might be multiple different things going on here in live event ticketing, and some aspects might really be more what we would think of as traditional consumer protection issues around disclosure, and some aspects may be more competition focused. So there are two different kinds of tools that maybe should be brought to bear in trying to promote more innovative and efficient results for fans in ticketing. But to talk a little bit about the competition question that you raised, you know, I think these cases are very difficult. We do see the antitrust division and the FTC really in the Biden administration, especially very focused on big and difficult conduct cases. As you noted earlier in the podcast, many of them involve online platforms, which of course in a digital ticketing market we're now in. And they're struggling with some of this because while there might be lots of different types of conduct and high market share, it can be very difficult for them to prove out harm or connect harm directly to the conduct as well. So I think the Section 2 cases that the agencies are currently pursuing and the Section 2 case that they may be investigating here is definitely one that could be quite challenging for the department. When you allude to exclusionary conduct and agreements, that those are might be more of a Section 1 type of case, that might be a little bit easier for the department than a very difficult Section 2 case. And I think it's interesting that both of you noted that there is conduct in the primary market that may be worth looking at for the Department of Justice, and also conduct in the secondary market as well. So I think it'll be interesting to see how the department pursues both of those areas and whether they choose to or not.
Certainly. Section 7 law, which is the merger statute, Clayton Act, is really the first line of defense to high concentration and dominant firms that can really limit competition and harm consumers in the process. So we will be watching very carefully how DOJ goes about crafting a case. And I like the point as well, Terrell, about consumer protection law, because there are big points of intersection between competition law and consumer protection law. Deceiving consumers, using information, sensitive information to enhance or leverage market power in a market. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. But I want to turn now to sort of looking forward. We know there's a problem. It's a high profile problem. It's being taken up through the antitrust enforcement channel. We have legislation at the federal and at the state level. So everyone acknowledges that there is a problem. And at the hearing on Live Nation in early 2023, there was bipartisan consensus that there's a problem in competition in live events. So I think it would be highly, highly unusual not to see something emerge from this chaos and this concern. The question is, what will it be? What policy tools will be chosen? And will those policy tools work together in a complementary way to promote competition in the interests of fans and artists in the creative arts? So how to fix this problem? And this goes back, Terrell, to the point you made earlier about structural versus conduct remedies. The conduct remedies that we saw in the 2010 decree and that were extended in the 2020 decree, they don't work well. They do nothing to change incentives to exercise market power. They require monitoring and enforcement and oversight. And I think most importantly, Behavioral remedies or conduct remedies really require smaller market participants to step up and complain. And if market participants are fearful, which they are, we hear it all the time, they won't step up and they won't complain. So the major enforcement mechanism for a conduct remedy does not exist in these particular markets because of the fear of retaliation. So, you know, all eyes are on structural remedies, and which mean breakups or break-offs. And we'll talk about that in more detail here in just a few minutes. But Terrell, tell us what you're thinking about. What is potentially the best remedy here? Is it to break off Ticketmaster from Live Nation to eliminate the incentive to force venues to take Ticketmaster's ticketing platform? Is that going to be enough? So basically undo the merger through a Section 2 case? Or does it involve more than that? For example, taking Ticketmaster and breaking it up into smaller parts to create more competition?
Well, Diana, I'd love to pose the same question to you since you've been writing extensively on the topic. I think it is very tempting, especially to the current enforcers, to think about big ideas like, breaking up companies and having big structural remedies because of how difficult and really unworkable behavioral remedies have been. And they've been very critical in this administration, I think, rightly so, of behavioral remedies and their lack of administrability by particularly antitrust enforcers who are not actually regulators. I do think, as we've been discussing, though, these cases are very, very hard, and it might be quite difficult and would probably take a number of years of litigation for the antitrust division to actually pursue that kind of remedy. I think it's interesting that you note that there's sort of multiple dimensions. It's venue, live events, ticketing in the primary market, but also the secondary market could be affected as well. And, you know, should the antitrust division pursue some kind of remedy or case there, I think is an interesting question that we'll have to see, you know, as things move forward. One of the real challenges, as you note, and it's been playing out already in some of the cases that the antitrust division is bringing, is, in the Biden administration, they have a very, broad view of the role of antitrust law and policing the marketplace, and a view that in many cases, antitrust law needs to be strengthened by Congress. I think one of the things that they're running into is, as you point out, the case law is a little bit disconnected from what the agenda is. These cases are hard; they are hard to prove, and the the division and the FTC, I think, have struggled to kind of bring strong enough cases under the current law, and so I think that'll be interesting again to see, you know, how and if things will play out in the context of live events. It's as you point out, I think an area that has attracted a tremendous amount of interest and scrutiny politically. Of course, the Taylor Swift on sale attracted a huge amount of global attention. Congress has been holding hearings. There's activity at the state level. The president has talked about these issues. So I can imagine that Department of Justice is under a lot of pressure to really be thinking about how to build a case.
Thanks, Terrell. I could not underscore more your really salient point about how long it would take to litigate a Section 2 case. Potentially longer than this administration has left, even if a second term were to materialize. These cases can go on for years. So, Russ, I want to ask you a really pointed question from your perch in the industry and as a very innovative business in ticketing. What do you think, looking forward, if you were king for the day, what would you want the ticketing market to look like moving forward that would really inject or re-inject needed competition so that we could return the live event space to a more competitive state and to really deliver value to fans and also to artists and to all of the smaller businesses that populate, you know, the various dimensions of the live event supply chain?
That's a very good question and one that I think about quite a bit. I wish that ticketing resembled every other industry where technology services are being purchased on the strength of what they have to offer and the price, the referenceability of customers, and things that are intrinsic in the offering itself. I wish that technology companies were much more focused on it, you know, that ticketing was a space that innovation was happening at a very rapid pace because there was a plethora of companies trying to outdo one another to create the best experience for primary rights holder clients and also the fans as well. And I think we've seen the secondary market be a good example of where there has been a lot of competition. There have been novel approaches where different companies have taken in order to satisfy consumers. You see some companies focus very heavily on being mobile app last minute focused, and they have a whole audience that they've developed around that and have product features and a suite around that. And then you see other companies leverage their brand and spend large amounts of money to be able to create that brand. Others have worked directly with sports teams. But it's all a long-winded way of saying, I just want to bring ticketing to a place where there is just much more vibrancy, competition, and innovation on behalf of the fan, who we ultimately all should be serving. And I think that probably bleeds to your next question, which is probably the tip of your tongue, which is, okay, well, we've talked about the different levers that the government can potentially take. What would return ticketing? What would bring ticketing to a place like that? And I struggle to think of anything that can happen that can help ticketing set it on a better path outside of separating Live Nation and Ticketmaster. And I don't want to jump to that conclusion. Obviously, I wish there was something that was more easily embraceable because obviously the threshold for that will be relatively high. But when you think about how behavioral remedies, and you know, you all are experts in how they can be quite problematic in other industries, but we've certainly seen the downsides of their ability in live entertainment, where whether it's explicit threats being made and cataloged in the 2020 amended consent decree, and also just the aura of fear that clouds our industry, where people are so afraid of making decisions that actually can help their organization and their fans and feel so compelled to ensure that they don't get penalized for stepping out of line, as you put it, and picking the wrong ticketing system. I think that's incredibly toxic. And I can't think of any way to solve the incentive problem other than making sure those incentives don't exist anymore.
I think this is a case of a magnitude that a full breakup and potentially a breaking, a full break off and potentially a breaking up of Ticketmaster would be necessary to restore competition to the markets. Interesting. I often get an interesting question, which is, well, could Live Nation not retain a small presence in ticketing? Wouldn't that be enough? And I think the answer to that is no, given the hard evidence we have from DOJ's investigation in 2020 about the types of threats and practices that we see. Terrell, I'll give you the last word on what we want the future of live events to look like from a competitive landscape point of view.
Well, I don't know if you should give me the last word, but I appreciate it. I think fans need to come first. And at the end of the day, I think fans benefit from competition and innovation in live events, in every aspect of live events. So I think what we need to do is really make sure that fans have access to their information about ticket pricing and sales, that they can, you know, confidently be able to make plans, but make changes if their plans change, and be able to avail themselves of a secondary market if that's necessary. And I think that it's probably a set of issues that, you know, frankly, are broader than just antitrust concerns, although I do think antitrust has an important role to play, obviously, in promoting competition. And I think the department is very engaged on that front. I do see, though, that we are dealing with issues that could also be consumer protection issues. And of course, there's been a lot of interest in from Congress as well in some legislative proposals that are being considered. So I think there is work to be done to make sure that the experience of fans in buying tickets and going to events is improved. And I'm glad to see that there's a lot of energy behind it at the moment.
Well said. And again, you know, full circle back to the earlier part of our conversation, this is a competitive problem of a magnitude that is going to require many different policy tools. Antitrust enforcement, consumer protection, legislation that increases and enhances transparency. And all of these pieces, moving pieces, need to work together to complement each other, to promote competition and the benefit and welfare of consumers and innovation in the creative arts, right? And in sports, which is a really, really important part of our society. And it's very important to consumers. And I think especially coming through the pandemic where people could not get out to go to live events and be social and partake in really important activities. You know, all of these problems that we've seen with the Springsteen dynamic pricing disaster and Taylor Swift and others, but also the smaller artists who really struggle to keep a voice in this debate because they are so small and they are buffeted by Live Nation, Ticketmaster. All of this sort of leads us to conclude that this is a really critical problem that really cannot languish for too much longer. But the solution to it is going to need to be very well thought out. So with that, I want to thank my guests today for a wonderful, thought-provoking conversation. Russ D'Souza, co-founder of SeatGeek, and Terrell McSweeney, senior of counsel at Covington and former FTC commissioner. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today and lending your expertise and your insights to a very important issue. And we will all continue to monitor and engage in this issue moving forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Diana.
Thanks for listening. Want to learn more about the Progressive Policy Institute? Follow us on Twitter at PPI and on Facebook at Progressive Policy Institute, or go to our website at progressivepolicy.org. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen and check back for new episodes. We'll talk with you soon.